Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight with Nikki Gemmell, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Nikki is well known, and I will introduce her only briefly. She's here on the occasion of the publication of her most recent book, Honestly, Notes on Life, by Nikki Gemmell. And Janet Grundy's got copies here, and I'm sure Nikki would be happy to sign some after the event. Nikki Gemmell's critically acclaimed fiction has been translated into many languages. Her novels include the international bestseller The Bride Stripped Bare, Shiva, The Book of Rapture, and With My Body. And she's also written two non-fiction books, Why You Are Australian and Pleasure, An Almanac for the Heart. Wollongong born, she was based in London for many years and has now returned to Australia with her family, and she writes, of course, a regular column in the Weekend Australian magazine. Now, tonight, we don't often do this, but Nikki is going to be interviewed by Alice Grundy, and then after Alice does the interview with Nikki, we'll come to questions and discussion from the floor as usual. Alice Grundy is known to many of you. She just told me it's 10 years since she left Canberra and came to Sydney, where Anne and I gave her a part-time job at the Sydney Institute. So she's she calls herself a Sydney Institute alumni. She's also worked in trade publishing and currently the managing editor at Gerimondo Publishing and editor of Seizure magazine, which is a print magazine, but has survived when many people thought it wouldn't and is prospering, as I understand it. So Alice Grundy is going to interview Nikki Gemmell about whatever comes to Alice's mind. Nikki Gemmell, you're very well.
Thank you, Jared. Well, thank you, Jared and Anne, for inviting me to do this in conversation with Nikki. I'm delighted to come along this evening. And I thought that we could start with the year that was in 2012, the year that was in publishing specifically. There's very little in common with your books and the 50 Shades of Grey books, but the re-release of The Bride Stripped Bare in 2012, you can see the cover on the table over there, the re-release meant that your novel entered the bestseller charts in the UK for the second time in its life. Can you talk a little bit about the popularity of fiction that explores female sexuality?
Whoa. Well, first of all, I would just like to say thanks to Anne and Jared for inviting me back. It's always wonderful, wonderful to be here. Jared, I hope I haven't traumatised you too much by asking for an interview.
Well, I've got over it.
I hope so. But you did say that Ondaatje was the...
Yes.
He's my all-time favourite author, so I'm very pleased to be following in his footsteps with that one. And back to your question, Alice. Thank you. I think last year was a watershed in women's reading. And yes, The Bride Stripped Bare and the 50 Shades books are very, very different books, different purposes. Everything about them is so different. But it's really exciting to kind of latch on in a little way to that whole phenomenon. I think it's a flowering of honesty and truth amongst women. And I started to think, wow, something seismic is going on here. When I was hearing conversations at the school gate, which is very much my world now, from women who you would just never expect to have conversations like that, saying, oh yeah, I could go there, I could do that. And it was like, gosh, what's going on here? And I think women have always very much enjoyed reading those kind of books, if they ever had access to them. But it was always very furtive and very secret. And if you were, you know, reading on the tube or the train or the bus or whatever, you'd be putting a magazine around it or whatever. And now it's like women are out and proud and kind of owning their sexuality in a really exciting way. For me, I've just finished, and one of the reasons why I did request that if it was possible we could have an interview, Jared, is because I'm in the maddest stage of my life at the moment. I've got a child starting, he's just started kindergarten, another child who's just started high school, a puppy that really needs to go off to puppy school, two other kids there in the mix, plus I've just finished the third in the Bride Street Bear trilogy, and also a children's book that's coming out this year. So life is completely crazy, and I'm basically going from one editor in London with the Bride book and another editor here in Sydney, simultaneously dropping editorial notes on my lap, trying to juggle all of that. It's been really, really, really hard. But for me, it's like now that I've finished this concluding book in the Bride Street Bear trilogy, it's called I Take You, and it's out in the middle of the year. For me, I kind of feel like I'm done. I'm done with that. It's something that I have loved exploring, that genre. I want to go on to something else now. But also I feel like I wonder if the readers will be done with this whole phenomenon too. I kind of wonder what is next for all of us who are kind of embracing the honesty, embracing the truth, the kind of raw and ugly and beautiful and terrifying world of a woman's secret sexuality, where does it go to from here? And I just wonder if perhaps there'll be a vast reining back in some way. You know, who knows? The publishing industry certainly doesn't know. I don't know. But for me personally, I feel like I've done all that I possibly can with that world for the moment. And I just need to put it behind me. But still, I'm excited by the whole flowering of truth and honesty. And certainly for me, with my non-fiction, my columns, I do find that so many people react to the honesty in them, and I don't want to lose that from my writing in any way. And that's what Bride taught me when it all came out, was how potent the truth is and how connecting. And it's so true, that adage, you know, only connect. And I think if you can do that through honesty, it's a very powerful tool as a writer. So that's what writing this kind of fiction has given me, kind of the flint of truth to connect.
So when you talk about connection, I wonder what effect writing a weekly column has had on both your writing but also the way in which you engage with your readers and your perception of the media landscape as well.
It was a big task. The Australian approached me to do it. And I had a big think about it because I just had a new baby and my life was crazy, and I just thought, gosh, the discipline of writing this 700 words week after week after week, it'll be a tough call. And I'd done it about 8 years previously with the Mail on Sunday in London. And what I had found then was I was writing those columns like they were a novel, and I'd draft and redraft, and I'd spend 6-7 days redrafting. So my whole world was that column. So when the Australian approached me, I said, I'll do it on the proviso that I can maintain somehow my fiction writing world. And I knew that I would have to be so disciplined to do that and to kind of have a set amount of time and then let it go. And so what the past year, 18 months has been a process of distilling and honing the way I work so that I can do it faster now. In fact, I can do my column in a day. People who know my writing, they say they can tell the difference. They can tell that I'm getting better at it. Sometimes I think, oh, okay, wasn't too good at the start, was it? I had to say that to them though. But I guess it's made me more economical as a writer. I love, love, love writing the column. I get so many responses. I must admit that some of the biggest columns was one I wrote on Julia Gillard, absolutely swamped by responses. One I wrote on Tony Abbott, absolutely swamped, including from the man himself who said, you must meet me because you've got me completely wrong. So I did, and yeah. And one recently that I wrote on female vitriol.
Yeah. I just have some of that here. Do you mind if I...
Yes, of course.
...read it out? One of the paragraphs was, female cruelty, such a flinched, dark, raging little world, given spectacular life by the Pandora's box of social media with its Machiavellian delights and delicious anonymity. A brave new world so embracing of sneer, jealousy, abuse, outspews a new mode of discourse, things that in the past women may have thought but never voiced. Civility, for the most part, used to prevent us from spitting such demeaning bile so openly. So what sort of response did you have to this column?
I guess you don't have the original letters there that were quoted in that column, do you?
No.
Basically, when I write the column in The Australian, there's a little email address at the bottom, so anyone can write. I just got another one, a shocker, today, because I wrote a column last weekend on Sylvia Plath, and just someone saying to me, oh, I can't even begin to say, they're horrible, and they have these letters do have the ability to nibble away at you and eat away at your confidence and your equilibrium. So I usually, you can tell in the first couple of words, a line, what they're going to be like. They usually don't say "Dear Nikki" in any way or sign off in any way. It's just this spewing forth of bile. But what I decided to do with two of these letters was quote them in the column, not mentioning the names, of course. And they're really, really shocking. And I just wanted to explore, I guess, that underbelly of the female psyche of things women may think but usually not say but feel like they have the power to say now in this kind of exhilarating world of social media and anonymity and whatever. But I could tell that they were women from their email addresses. And I'm fascinated by that. And I got so many letters from so many women within the workplace who said that they've come across that, or they witnessed that, or they're managers and they're trying to manage younger women. And I also got so many letters from bewildered men who work within predominantly all-female environments, kind of bewildered and befuddled that women do this to each other. And the two biggest culprits in terms of professions were nursing. So many people who work in the nursing profession say this, and teaching. Yeah, so I was fascinated by that, and I feel like I have to do a follow-up column. I was going to say on ways of getting through this and coping with all of this, but I'm no expert on all of that.
So I was reading that the inspiration for your first novel came out of a journalistic assignment that you were on. You were talking a little bit about the way that you write your column has changed over time. Hmm. Do you completely compartmentalise? Does one inform the other?
How do you mean fiction and non-fiction?
Yes.
It's hard when you're a writer generally, and a criticism of my column from some people is that it's too poetic. It's not journalistic enough. It's not kind of dry enough for them. It's like, you know, we're used to reading this in novels, but we don't really want to read this in a newspaper. But for me, I use poetry as my tuning fork. Michael Ondaatje, the most extraordinary poet, and, you know, the poetry of his lines bleeds into his fiction. He's just extraordinary, and I guess for someone like me, I look at that and think, that's what I want to be. Another one of my favourite writers, Anne Michaels, another Canadian, she's also a poet, is a novelist as well. And so when I write non-fiction, that's my mark and my standard, that I want to write beautiful prose. I want to be uplifted by beautiful prose. Some of my favourite columns I've written are about basically nothing. One of them was writing about a mulberry tree and just watching the kids in the schoolyard climb up and eat mulberries. And with those ones, it's almost like poetry. And I have very little to do with the managers of The Australian at all, so all I ever deal with is my wonderful, wonderful, inspiring editor at the magazine, a woman called Christine Midup. But I have no idea what the rest of the newspaper thinks of the whole thing, whatever. I haven't met all those people or whatever, so I just keep on doing what I'm doing. You know, I don't know.
You were talking about your children. It's been 4 years since you wrote Why You Are Australian, mm-hmm. which in a way was a letter to your children.
Yes.
Is there anything that you would change that's come out of your experience in those 4 years?
Why You Are Australian was a book I wrote when I'd lived in London for about 15 years, and my husband and I had this tussle for many, many years about whether we'd come back or not and raise our kids in Australia. And my husband very much is an Anglophile, and I, for a long time, was an Anglophobe. Embarrassingly, I had the light in my bones, and, you know, the southern sky was just singing me home for years and years and years and years. I couldn't get it out of my system. And so what I decided to do was just leave the bloke for a term and bring the kids back to Australia and stay near my family. And just be with them, because we have ageing parents. But crucially, I had two grandmothers then who were nearing 100. One of them is 100 on Thursday, and the other one sadly passed away since then. But I just wanted to be with them, to just revel in them, because it had been so long, and they'd helped to raise me. So I was very close to both of them. And so I brought my kids back, just put them in a little tiny public school on the shores of Lake Macquarie for a term. My little Londoners with their Hugh Grant haircuts and their pale, pale, pale skin. And they just kind of honeyed up and turned into little Aussies. And so I wrote a book about that. My one regret about that book is that I was so harsh on England. And I think if I was writing it now, I'd be less rosy-eyed about Australia and more clear-eyed about the country I'm living in. But I think that's kind of a mark of a writer. We have the observer's eyes, and it's hard to actually write about a place that you're totally immersed in. And I Take You is a modern-day version of Lady Chatterley's Lover, set in a communal garden in Notting Hill. And I lived in Notting Hill for almost 15 years. And it basically ends with the London riots of 18 months ago, July 2011. And I could never write about that world within the thick of living in it. But now that I'm away from it, it came very clearly and very easily, being able to write about that environment. Just like I've never tackled Sydney. I've lived in Sydney on and off my whole life, but I've never been able to write in it. Mm. John Updike said about New York that it was almost too noisy to write in, and I feel like that with Sydney. It's noisy and it's clangy and it's so known, and I have family and I have friends stretching back to primary school, you know, everyone kind of wanting a piece of you and all of that. It's hard to actually write about this world, and perhaps if I don't live in it again, I'll be able to.
Well, on that, do you ever feel a tug back towards London? Do you think you could live there again?
I do! It's funny. The longer I'm here, I do. I guess perhaps that's also the mark of a writer, or human nature, perhaps, that we're perpetually dissatisfied on some level and think the grass is always greener. Now that I'm away from London, I miss so much that feeling of being immersed in the centre of the world, just walking down Soho, and you feel like all of life is around you, that everyone from all over the world is here in this place, and there's such a scruffy, big, ragged, dynamic energy to it that's incredibly exhilarating. I also miss my darling, darling London Library, which is where I wrote several books. It's this deeply eccentric institution on St. James Square, and it was set up by Dickens, amongst others, in 1846 as a tool house for writers. And it's run along the lines of an old gentleman's club that you have to be nominated, and kind of it's a bit hard to get into, and it's very expensive. I couldn't afford to keep up my membership. But it's an exhilarating place to work, and there was a real coterie of writers there, which was very stimulating, although after a while, drove me bananas, because we'd go for lunch every day, and all you'd be talking about is publishers and book deals and agents and film deals, and everyone seemed to be doing so much better than you, and it was kind of, after a while, it just completely infects you and that kind of thing. But I do miss that world. Very, very much. And in fact, one of the writers there. My husband just told me yesterday, John O'Farrell, he's about to stand as a Labour MP. And so it's like, oh my God, this whole world is expanding out and I feel so far away from it now. Mm. But hey, I don't think there's a better place in the world to raise children than here. And that's the main reason why we're back.
And overseas, your novels have had a really great reception, particularly in France. Do you think that is in part a result of your having lived as an expat or to do with the nature of the content in your writing?
I don't think it's got anything to do with being an expat at all. I must admit, with France, some of my favourite writers, besides the Canadians, are the French women. Colette, particularly, who no one reads very much anymore. But you go back to some of her earlier stuff, not so much the fiction, but the non-fiction, and it's so truthful and warm and tender and honest. And also Marguerite Duras, the lover. So I love a lot of French female writers. But I think France was always intrigued because, actually, when I wrote Bride, my publishers there, Belfond, were completely horrified because they'd set me up as this Aussie adventurer, because I'd done Shiver set in Antarctica, Cleve set in Central Australia. So I was like the Crocodile Dundee girl, and you know, and then suddenly I was writing the Bride Street Baroness. But we write sex, and you're not meant to be doing that. So I changed publishers at that point. I don't know. I must admit, when Bride came out, what I loved was that I was getting letters from all over the world. You know, it's been translated into about 25 languages, and but they were universal stories, and so it felt like it was touching on just universal themes of womanhood. So it didn't matter from where you were from or whatever, and that gets back to my whole thing that I was saying at the start, that honesty connects.
And you were saying that you've just finished up the final in the Bride series. Does that employ the second person as well? And do you think that you will move away from that in the future?
Do you find it difficult?
No, actually, I really like it. It's almost impossible to do well.
It's such a good question because I had a real tussle with this third one because Bride Street Bear and its follow-up With My Body, they're both written in the second person, as in, you did this, you did that, you walked to the shops, you whatever. And I love the intimacy it implies, but also the sense of distance. So it's a very rigorous form of writing, and I think you can only have very short books. It's very hard to sustain it over a long novel because it's a very intense way of writing. And I first chanced upon it when I was writing The Bride Street Bear and the voice just didn't ring true. I tried the first person and it felt too indulgent and it just icky or something, just writing I with just things that were so intimate. But also the third person, it didn't feel connected enough. And so I picked up Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City, and he does it beautifully in that. So for Bride, he was my tuning fork in terms of the voice. And then I did it with My Body, and then I tried to do it with I Take You, and it just didn't work. It was, but I think perhaps it was me getting sick of it. And I think some of the reviewers have said, oh, come on, look, we're over this now. That's her tick. That's her thing, second person. I'd also written a book called The Book of Rapture in between, which was also second person. I was kind of obsessed with the whole form. And I'm over that now. And so I've written I Take You in the third person because it is literally, I went back to Lawrence and, I, you know, what did he write? And he wrote very powerfully in the third person. So as an homage to him, that's what I did too. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to reading it. And could you talk a little bit about working on a children's book at the same time as this Lawrence invocation?
It's hard. This is something that's been brewing for several years, and writing never gets easier. I don't know if other writers say that. It's like I've never worked out the magic formula for doing it. You know, early on in my career, people would say to me, what's the secret, what's the trick? And I'd say, oh, God, just write as if you're dying. It's a great motivator. And I found this children's book one of the hardest things to do. And it's taken me years and years and years to crack it. And I still don't know if I've cracked it. I have a sense of uncertainty about all my writing. It's odd. It's almost a feeling of disappointment that... I suppose I shouldn't be saying this because no one will ever want to buy one of my books again. But I set out with such grand plans of this is what I'm going to do. This is going to be the one. I'm going to crack it this time. And then it's a gradual process of, oh, it kind of runs away from me, the whole book, and it turns into something else, almost of its own accord. And it's like when I get to the end of it, it's, okay, well, it didn't quite come out the way it worked. Maybe the next time. And that, in a way, is what fuels me. But I must admit, as a writer, what also fuels me, and I do it with my columns every week, is a violent reaction to the previous work that I've done. So with my columns, if you read them kind of one after the other, they're very different. You know, one week it'll be kind of humorous about motherhood. The one coming out this Saturday is about the quality of openness in your life, just kind of being open to the world. It was sparked by... because my son was starting high school, there are lots of, you know, rumours and flurries about certain teachers and the headmaster and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to shield him from this. I wanted to go into that world totally open, not hearing, you know, all the buzz about the problems or whatever, or the irritations. I just wanted him to make up his own mind and be his own person. So that little thought sparked a whole column about openness. And then the week after, I've got one on drones. And when I filed it, I actually thought, oh, I wonder if Philip Adams will get kind of, because it's his territory and not mine. I don't know, but they seem to let me do whatever I want. And so I find also with my fiction that I love doing something that kind of reacts or bounces off the previous work in some way. And so I've actually loved disappearing into a world of children's fiction. And this one is also my first historical novel. It's set in December 1945 in London, in Kensington, just after the end of World War II. So I had to kind of recreate that whole world of a Britain kind of hauling itself back on its feet during rationing and, you know, rubble everywhere still and facades of buildings and kind of just struggling to have a proper Christmas, with the world struggling to have a proper Christmas again after, 5-6 years of not having Christmas, that kind of thing. So that's the world of the children's book. I'm loving doing it. I don't know what I'm going to do next. Have a rest, I think.
I think you deserve it. And to finish off, would you like to read from your latest book? You have a
okay, just,
you would like to read.
Do I have time, Jared? Thank you. This is just one. This is, as well as the Tony Abbott and the Gillard columns and the female vitriol. Oh, and also one that I wrote about buying a puppy, which I did not realise the waves of... Because I happened to mention that I bought the puppy in a pet shop and I just... It unleashed the forces of hell upon me. I had no idea you're not meant to buy puppies in pet shops. But I do now. I do now. Anyway, but I also wrote two columns... one was sparked by a goddaughter, and I wanted to write a little letter to her. She's only very young, she's only a year old now, just about being a woman in this world. And that got such a huge response that then I wrote one about boys as well. And I've had so many people come up to me afterwards saying, oh, we were at a parent-teacher night, and the teacher had photocopied copies of the magazine page and given them all out to us, or that, you know, a headmaster at a farewell dinner, he'd read out the whole thing. And I thought, wow, it touches, it connects. I really wrote this in a way, I've got three sons, for my sons as much as anything. It's so hard. I mean, it's so hard to raise girls as well as boys, but so hard to raise boys now. I just feel like they get such a rough trot in so many ways. So this is something. And I also, in the book, it was lovely because HarperCollins let me rework the columns so I could expand and make them a bit better. Okay. I celebrate the young men in my life. Yes, they're regular rough and tumble boys who love their Nerf guns and footy, but alongside that stack the dishwasher and cook and have sensitive, questing conversations about relationships, grown-ups, life. That's what this generation of mothers are teaching their boys. These complex, tender, open, and lovely young men who have us roaring with laughter. We can't wait. I'm sorry, I'm so blind. I'm going to have to put my glasses on. I feel like I'm being rude. We can't wait to see how this generation will grow up, how they'll treat women, change the world, that we worry for them too. May they never be crushed, by women most of all. Those mocking attitudes increasingly on show in blockbusters like Brave, the children's film. So here they are, little lamplights of observation for those beautiful, shining boys in our lives. May you have the soldering fellowship of good, reliable mates. Never be afraid to speak out if you're not happy. Real mates will support you. Never underestimate the healing power of a man hug. There's no greater bonding signal. Keep your head pulled in. Tell your friends to pull theirs in too if need be. Impulsive behaviour is often not the best. Thoughtful action gives you leeway to find a better way. Slow down, watch, think. The world, your team, your peers may still expect a particularly male response. If that isn't right, don't be that person. Have the wisdom to know that strength can come through tenderness, gentleness, and that calm resolve will always beat boorish behaviour. Remember, a gentleman always does the kind thing. May you never clamp down, shut off, slink away into grumpiness. We women see little boys bursting with light and spark and life, and then something happens, we're not quite sure what. A retreat into sullenness, inarticulateness. The brightness dampened as life chips away at them. May you have the gift of a male mentor who's not your parent. Someone who filters advice you're getting from mates, tells you what's what, allows you to be emotionally open, and who steers you through those days of self-doubt and indecision. The awakening, the awe. I wish you'd read as much as you play computer games. Lift up that beautiful head of yours, gulp the world, travel, pick a footy team and stick with it through its tough times as well as triumphant. Seize the joy of a physical sport so you can learn to be as tough as nails on the field as it prepares you for the great journey ahead and teaches you that getting knocked down is all part of life and getting up again is the real challenge. I wish you a sense of self that's comfortable rather than conformational. Don't be afraid of eschewing convention, of embracing difference, the other. Don't cover up your fears with base, herd-like behaviour. Have the courage to be different, for you may find that by your actions you lead by example and give boys around you something to follow, to look up to. Don't be afraid to be vulnerable. It's a close cousin to honesty and people always respond to the truth. Your real self will know its false opposite. Don't succumb to it. I wish you discipline, self-control. From that comes great achievements. Perseverance is the key. I wish you the ability to love and to articulate it. Be passionate about what you love and who you love. Take risks, have fun, laugh a lot. Don't be too serious. Don't be afraid to sing. And finally, remember that little boy you once were. May you never entirely grow up. Never lose that joy that sings through you as you arc across a creek on a tire, skateboard down a path, whoosh through the surf on a boogie board. All the women who cherish you are looking at it. I'm going to cry, sorry. Their hearts in their mouths, well, yes, but giggling at the sheer, lovely, crazy, life-affirming beauty of it and wanting you to retain something of it forever. Thank you.
Well, many thanks, Nikki Gemmell. I'm sort of weeping myself. No one ever wrote me a letter.
Sharon!
before we go to questions and discussion, I should say thanks to Nikki, but thanks for a stunning performance by Alice Grundy.
Yes,
I've said,
thank you.
I've said for quite a while now. I'm very surprised that so far neither the ABC nor Sky News has picked up Alice, but I'm sure it might happen. Well done. Terrific job. So questions, discussion. So when these three boys grow up, and you'll stop weeping about it.
I'll never stop weeping.
And of the many books, some of them are here, what would you... Is there anyone you'd hope they don't read?
Oh, Gerard! I must admit, my husband took the kids up to Cairns Airport last year, and the eldest one, who's just started high school, there was Bride and With My Body there at Cairns Airport bookshop, and he went, oh, look, look, Mummy's books! And he ran up to them and flipped open to the first page, and the father-in-law was there too, and the mother-in-law. It was like, oh my God, and then my husband just whipped it out of his hands, and we thought, yeah, it's time to start putting things up on literally the top shelf so I can't read them. But I must admit, when he's when the boys are, I don't know, 16, 18, I will certainly let them read any of the books, because I think, you know, any of my sexier ones, they're manifestos as much as anything. They're manifestos of womanhood, of what women perhaps really want and what we don't want. So if it teaches them in some small way to be better men, better lovers, whatever, I'm all for that. But just not yet, because he's only 12.
I'm going up the back, then up the front. Yep.
Nikki, your writing's terribly fair.
And do you want to...
Well, columns are terribly, as you say. The deadline's there. It looks so simple, but it can take a long time. And the actual on the page isn't what really happens. What happens is what crystallises in your brain for the week.
Yeah.
How do you do that? What? How do you choose your topic? Because you're not writing foreign policy or economics or whatever. You're actually trying to bring to the reader something that makes them think, challenges them, and it gives them enjoyment. So what goes on in your week that brings that all about?
It's hard. It's really hard, and it's getting harder. For about the first year of the columns, I just had a kind of tumult of ideas that all came kind of spewing forth and bursting out, and I don't want to repeat myself. And I must admit, I don't want to give up the gig because I love it. I kind of look across enviously to the back of the magazine where Philip is and think, gee, he's got Late Night Live. All that wealth of material at his fingertips, you know, four nights a week. But I must admit, I'm like a bowerbird. You know, I read everything that I can seize. The column on drones, that was, I do a little gig on the Today program on a Friday morning, and the cabbie that takes me to and from Channel 9, he's always got Time in the back of it. And you know, just last Friday, I was just flipping through his Time magazine, and there was a great article on drones, and I thought, that's going to make a great column. Very kindly, he let me have the Time magazine to do that. But that's my world now. It's constantly, things are just sparked, often at the school gate. I find there's a wealth of wisdom there. These are thinking, engaged women. And, you know, from the outside, they look like mothers have given up on their world or whatever. And they are so present in terms of what's going on and what they think and the perspective of everything. And so I love just sitting there in the afternoon, picking up the kids from school and yakking. And I will often be sparked by a conversation from that. And I haven't had a complete disaster yet where I've got to Sunday night, because my ideas always have to brew. Monday is my big writing day, and I haven't got to a Sunday night yet where I've thought, oh, what am I going to do? And I must admit, I also deeply love still the British papers, and that's another thing I miss hugely, hugely about being here. The fact that in the UK you have 10 national newspapers, with all the glorious diversity of opinion that gives you. I'm so excited about The Guardian coming here with its new website. I think that's going to be a shot up the bum for so many media organisations. I cannot wait And it's getting some great journalists as well. So every day I read The Guardian online and I read the Daily Mail online. If people know their British newspapers, they're polar opposites. But it gives me a huge breadth of opinion. And I read the Sunday Times. I'm just kind of addicted to my reading habits. So they're kind of giving me ideas too. I must admit, being back in Australia, and my publishers tell me this too, Australia is a much more conservative society than Britain, and you'll get much more kind of out there writing in the UK. And my column last week on Sylvia Plath that mentions the C word, which you really wouldn't think twice of doing in the UK in an article there, but in Australia I was kind of like, my heart was in my mouth and thinking, oh, should I do this, can my readers handle this, blah blah blah. So I'm getting my ideas from anyone and everyone, and also readers. A lot of the time I'll find that columns will be in fact the column on openness that's coming out this Saturday was sparked by the column on female vitriol, and this wonderful woman wrote in and said, you must read George Saunders, who I think is in the New York Times bestseller list at the moment. He's a novelist, he's a non-fiction writer, he's an essayist, he's wonderful, and you can feel the excitement generating. You know, the New Yorker is suddenly doing profiles on him. He's been a writer out there in the world for about 20, 30 years, but his time has come. And it was a reader who pricked my interest in him, and that sparked a whole column. So I love being open to anything, and that's where my ideas are coming from. But can I ask you, Jared, because you're a columnist too, do you find it really, really hard, or because you've got a narrower kind of range in terms of what you write about, is it easier?
Oh, it's just a habit.
I couldn't describe what I do, it's just a habit.
Well, I've missed a week in 26 years, I just sort of do it, it's just what you do. So Monday morning you do a column, and Monday afternoon you finish it and go home and walk the dog.
but do you write to be provocative?
You're now interviewing me.
I'm fascinated. I'm much more comfortable interviewing than talking.
So what was your question?
What is your aim as a columnist? Because I used to, like with my Julia Gillard and my Tony Abbott, I used to be so kind of flinched at the kind of responses that I got. And then the Australian was going, no, 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 we love that. We love the hatred and the vitriol because it sparks something in the readers. And it's like, oh, okay, so I just have to grin and bear it. Do you write to be provocative?
No, I'd never try to upset anyone, but
okay.
Occasionally I do. I mean, and every now and then the Sydney Morning Herald says to me, look, we've got 90 letters today, but they're all critical of you. Or sometimes there's one supporter, and I say, where did that one come from? So I mean, they don't publish 90, of course. I try to say things, but I never upset people personally. I don't do any personal stuff, but as to ideas, I think I probably upset a few people. I don't really notice it much. I get a lot of angry stuff occasionally. The angrier the note, the more polite the response, I find. If people are really angry with you, they hate you if you respond politely. So I always respond very politely.
But I don't respond to those. That's interesting that you would engage. Because then you have to read them. I feel like I'm not strong enough to read all the bile.
Well, I'm used to it. I get very surprised if anyone ever agrees with me. So
right.
So I don't.
Okay.
Anyway, no one's come to listen to me. There's a question here. Okay.
Hi. Nikki, you said that it doesn't become...
Speak into the microphone.
You said that it doesn't get easier as you write, but does the craft become easier? Do you know, like, how long it's going to take to write something, or how to shape something, or are you quicker in editing it, or...
Yes, the craft gets easier if you're doing exactly the same as what you're doing previously. For like with I Take You, because I'd written two previous books in that genre, like Bridesstrip Bear and With My Body, yes. And I must admit, and it feels terrible to almost say this, but I care less, but I think in a positive way, because when I was younger, I was so passionate, and in terms of these books were my babies and my heart and soul was in them. And the whole anonymity thing with the Bradstreet Bear, it was originally published anonymously, was because I cared too much. And I couldn't, I was getting to the point where I couldn't bear putting myself out there so much into the world and being ripped apart in the process. I wasn't brave enough to face that. And I thought anonymity was a way of just dissociating myself from the whole process and just letting go. And I guess it's a process of maturing too. I must admit, I maybe shouldn't be saying this, and this can go no further. Oh no, I can't say who it is. I was at a Sunday lunch a couple of years ago with a very, very, very famous female novelist who's now in her 70s in the UK. And make of that what you will. And we were talking about books and writing, and I said, oh, you know, look, I've been offered a lot of money to write a book that I'm not really comfortable with, but, you know, I've got kids who are entering high school in a couple of years, and I've got a perhaps school fees and all the rest of it. And she was like, Nikki, just do it. Just take the money and do it. She said, you know, she's written a lot of books in her lifetime. She's had a very long career, very respected. And she said, no one will notice. It was extraordinary for her to say that. But she just said, the critics don't notice. There's someone from my publishers in this room. She said, the publishers don't necessarily notice. The only people who will really notice are a few diehard fans, and they will write letters to you, very passionate, and you just write back to them. And but the rest of the world won't notice. And, you know, this is a working woman, a mother. She'd spent her whole life writing books. And in her 70s, she'd come to the conclusion that it is a business, that we women have to stop caring so much about what we do to the point that we bleed, or that we're so insecure about the whole thing or whatever. We just have to treat it professionally, take the money, do a very good professional job, and don't care. And, you know, don't break our backs trying to deliver something that's almost like a child to us. And I must admit, that conversation was extraordinarily liberating as a writer to hear that. And ever since then, a part of me has just let go. And so with I Take You, that I just finished it today, and I just sent off my last query to my editor, and I'm waiting for her to email overnight, and then I can just send it off to her completely, that it's done and dusted. It feels very clean. It feels fast and clean and strong, I think, because I have just let go of all the angst and the worry. So I guess, getting back to your question, perhaps it does get easier because I care less. Another fantastic writer to read in terms of the whole process of writing over a lifetime is Sebald, W.G. Sebald, the English writer. He talks a lot about uncertainty, and how as you age, you embrace uncertainty. And it's a positive thing. And he died tragically kind of early. I think he was in his early 60s when he died. And kind of everyone felt that the best of his books were yet to come. It was such a tragic loss. But as he got older, he became very suspicious of the narratorial voice within fiction in terms of its certainty, the omniscient narrator who knows everything, because he felt that as we get older, we open up our world to uncertainty and to wonder. So his novels are classed as fiction, but they're kind of an odd mix of memoir, photography, everything. But they're just kind of soaked in a world of uncertainty, like his last couple of books, and it's wonderful and liberating to read that.
I'm not sure this is working.
I'm sure I don't.
Well, give it a go. Yeah.
Did you have to fight hard with your publisher to get anonymous on Bri?
Yes, it was. I feel like that book will dog me for the rest of my life. I started writing a book fully intending to put my name to it, and just wanted to write very, very honestly about sex within marriage and relationships. I was newly married myself. I had a young son and I was pregnant with another child. So I was in certain circumstances myself that as I was writing this book that was going to have my name on it, I was very kind of cautious and trying to protect too many little worlds around me. And I was closed up. I was censoring myself constantly. And so several months into the writing process, I read Virginia Woolf, A Room of One's Own. And in that, she says, you know, anonymity is a woman's refuge in terms of writing and in terms of our voice. And it was just like a light bulb went off in my head. I thought, of course, I'll just disappear from this. And that gave me an incredible freedom to just say everything and anything that I wanted to that I might have been thinking for years but had never had the courage to say. And it was exhilarating. I was liberated. The writing, the work just galloped from that point. It felt so strong and so sure. And then the book, I gave it into my agent and he very quickly sold it to HarperCollins. And then the book went to the Frankfurt Book Fair, the big world fair of books in Germany. And I'm a former journalist myself, and I just read, I think it was in the Daily Telegraph in London, this tiny, tiny little article saying that there was this book that had caused a sensation at the Frankfurt Book Fair, and everyone wanted to know who had written it. And from that moment, I knew I was doomed, because I knew that the way that article was written, someone would be tracking me down. And because there was all this speculation that it was written by Salman Rushdie's ex-wife. and lo and behold, it didn't take long. Being an ex-journo myself, the kind of in the rarefied world of the ABC and little ABC radio, I suddenly had journos knocking on my door in our little news house off Portobello Road. In the middle of the night, I had a young baby waking up screaming. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible process. And the upshot was, I'd given this book to HarperCollins. I had a wonderful editor there, but it hadn't been edited yet. So as soon as I was outed, very traumatically, I marched into HarperCollins with my big red pen, and I was like, Courtney, Courtney, I had to delete. You know, I just, there is so much there, I cannot bear to put my name to. I just can't. And we had a huge tussle. She was this gorgeous New Yorker, but very strong and very opinionated. And she basically sat me down. She was crying. I was crying. And she basically said, Nikki, those passages, I can still remember exactly what ones they are. Those passages that you want to get rid of are the ones that connect the most, because they're so excruciatingly honest. And I don't think she said, I won't let you delete them, because I don't think an editor has that power, but she basically convinced me to keep them in. There might have been one or two that I did delete. but that was the tussle that we had. And then when the book came to be published, so it was published here and in the UK and various markets, still with By Anonymous on the cover, because for me that was harking back to Virginia Woolf once again. I wanted it as a statement of this is an anonymous woman and women are freed, their voices are freed by anonymity. That suddenly, you know, the corset is unloosed. We can say, we can feel all those things that we're not allowed to articulate. So it was a statement. It was like every woman and any woman, this book. But then it got to the American market, and which is so powerful, dictated by Barnes and Noble and Borders. You know, they have the right to choose a cover. In fact, these two covers here, The Bradstreet Bear and With My Body, they were chosen by W.H. Smith in England. When 50 Shades of Grey took off, W.H. Smith contacted HarperCollins and said, we want to resell Bride if you can get us a 50 Shades-esque cover overnight. And so basically a designer at HarperCollins in London came up with those two designs overnight to get them back onto the bookshelves. And so booksellers have enormous power. And in America, the booksellers absolutely refused to have By Anonymous on the cover because they'd gone through all the primary colours thing. And they just said, it's a hot potato, we just will not touch it. And so that was the first market where I had to swallow my pride, or what was left of it, and just say, well, I have to bow to the booksellers there. and it had my name on the cover, fresh into that market. And ever since, it's just like, I've given up. So, worn down, kind of.
Final question up the back. Yeah.
Nikki, I remember all of that. I remember your tour in Australia, but I also remember a radio presenter who was interviewing Jared from Radio National, and he really believed you'd written your story. Yeah. And
was that what I worked with?
Didn't last, much longer as a result. This was quite serious. And I just wonder how much of that kind of thinking was present in some of the interviews you did, that, you know, this was news strip bear, and that they couldn't imagine that you created a world that didn't exist.
Yep.
To what extent did that then become another tussle for you?
It was absolutely a tussle and a very, very traumatic one. Yes, for me, but more so for my husband. You know, he had a corporate life in London. He'd walk into boardrooms and the secretaries would be sniggering and saying, oh, that's him, that's the husband. And I just think he had enormous confidence in the relationship to get through it all. It could have sunk us, but it didn't. And I must say, getting back to that terrible, terrible, traumatic time when my publishers in Australia, the book had taken off, and they basically said, we want you to explain this, we want you to come out. And so I did, I was jet-lagged, I did a whirlwind book tour of about a week, going all over the country, trying to explain this book to a very, very, very cynical media. I walked out on Philip Adams on Late Night Live. I'm not proud of any of that. I could not get through my story. And there was one journalist who took me absolutely straight and let me talk and let me tell my story and came with no cynical preconceptions in a way. And to this day, I'm still astounded that it was this person in terms of their career trajectory and how they operate and the vitriol that they get themselves, and that was Alan Jones. And it was the morning, the Australian of all people, now that I'm writing for them, my husband and I still talk about the irony of me actually writing for this newspaper, they tore me apart. And they seem to do this sometimes. They have a campaign that they want to bring someone down. And for that time, I was that target. And I can remember there was a front page story on this particular morning that I was scheduled to go onto the Alan Jones program. And it was basically a big front page story on the Australian saying I was basically a fraud and blah, blah, blah. And it was so traumatic. It was so excruciating. And I thought, I can't go on air. I can't, at 8:30, whatever it was, I just can't after this has come out. And I thought, no, I have to. I'm professional. I can't, you know, let someone down. So I walked in there with my heart in my mouth. And he was great. He, you know, he didn't even refer to it. It was like he wanted to give me a fair go, or he saw through what the newspaper was trying to do or whatever. And so, you know, you hear so much about Alan Jones, but I will never forget that moment of otherness and kindness that stood out so strongly amongst the kind of general hum of all the media following everyone else.
Thanks, Nikki. Thank you. So I'll be very brief. I never make comments on speakers' talks, but I do disagree with one comment that you made. It's never a mistake to walk out on Philip Adams.
Good to know.
Thanks to Ellis Grundy for a great performance. Thanks to Coors Chambers Wethgar for providing this fine facility. As I said, Nikki Gemmell's latest book, Honestly, Notes on Life, which is a collection of her columns in the Weekend Australian magazine. Janet Grundy's got some copies of that, and some of Nikki's other books here, as you can see on the table. Look, it's been a stimulating night. I've learned a lot. It's been entertaining. It's been witty. And
you say that to everyone.
No, I don't, actually. It's been very, very front on, I think. Very, very full on. I mean, Nikki said at one stage that she thought
by putting on her glasses she was hiding. I noticed she left them on, but...
I forget!
It was a great performance, so well done, and we'll have you back again sometime.
Thank you.
We're not quite sure what your next move is, you see.
I'm not either.
Yeah, you implied you're moving out of one genre, but we're not sure what you're moving into, so we'll find out. So for tonight, well done, and congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.